Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Admit One, the film podcast that delves into the movie viewing habits of film fanatics and industry insiders from across the arts.
One of my favourite things that I can get from a movie is that feeling of sort of bittersweetness.
Today's guest is journalist and author Mr. Tim Walker.
It definitely finishes with him trying to wipe a scar off a statue of himself and saying, "Call off Christmas."
Tim, welcome to Admit One. I hear you're just back from LA, so thank you for joining us, even though you say you're terribly jet-lagged, but you're looking okay.
Oh, thanks. That's good. I'm a little cold, yeah, a little spaced out, but I made it.
So, Tim, you're a writer, but I want to go straight back to the beginning before we talk about your brand new book. How did you become a journalist?
Well, the first thing that made me want to be a journalist, in my first year of college, I went to see Almost Famous, the Cameron Crowe movie, and the next day, I went out and I bought a pair of the biker boots that Billy Crudup wears, and that he's the guitarist in the band, and that. And then I also went to the college newspaper and told them that I wanted to write music reviews. And I think the music editor at the time sort of handed me a copy of the first Gorillaz album and sent me away with it. And I wrote 90 words about it, probably unintelligible. And that was my first piece of journalism.
Gosh, so films actually sculpted your career.
I guess so, yeah. Yeah, that was the inspiration for it. Almost Famous didn't make my top three favourite movies, but it's been pretty influential, I guess.
Oh, it's such a great film. So coming of age for the journalist in the film, isn't it? And by the end, he's something of a man. At the beginning, he's such a boy. And Kate Hudson, so beautiful. I mean, Penny Lane. Doesn't everyone want to be a bit more like Penny Lane?
And it's got a great Philip Seymour Hoffman performance in it as well. I guess it's about whether you should meet your heroes or not, because he finds out that these people aren't quite as great as he thought they were at the beginning. And I think that's kind of a lesson for us all, too.
It's interesting because on Admit One, this idea of meeting your hero has come up a lot. From living in LA, have you had that moment yourself?
Yeah, it's hard. You know, if someone asked me who's your hero, I'd be hard-pressed to...
It's a big question.
Yeah, it's a big question. And, you know, you want to pick Nelson Mandela or something, but I'm not sure. I did, by pure chance, find myself at the home of Robert Town, the screenwriter of Chinatown, one afternoon about a year ago. It's a long story how I got there and not a very interesting one, but he descended from his garret above the garage and sort of came down and had coffee with us. And I said something embarrassing to him. And yeah, so I guess that was meeting a hero.
They're the people that have that control over you that make you the less composed person and grown up that you think you are, and you end up spitting out some kind of stupid question or saying something a bit like, damn it.
So it's not necessarily meeting your hero. They might turn out to be disappointing, but you will definitely turn out to be disappointing when you meet your hero, that's for sure.
So your new book, Smoke Over Malibu, is being sold as The Big Lebowski meets Lovejoy. I mean... killer combination, but I would like to know, what exactly does that mean?
Well, it's like The Big Lebowski. It's a kind of a pastiche of the hard-boiled detective genre. It's about a guy who's a... you could say he's a failed screenwriter, although he would say he was a sort of voluntarily retired screenwriter. And he now works in the antiques business in Los Angeles, which is where the Lovejoy comparison comes in. And a sort of mystery type plot arises out of various personal and professional activities of his. And so hopefully it's partly as funny as The Big Lebowski, and it definitely has antiques in it. So that's why I love Joy.
So that is the cross between the two.
Yeah.
What inspired Smoke Over Malibu?
Well, it started from that point of my first book was very much a book about London, even though it wasn't all set here. It was a London novel. And this second one, I was living in LA and I wanted to write about Los Angeles. And to me, the kind of the Los Angeles genre is the detective novel, is Raymond Chandler. He's the kind of Charles Dickens of what Charles Dickens is to London, Raymond Chandler is to Los Angeles, I think. And so I naturally wanted to sort of work along those lines. I wanted to write a little bit about movies because I've loved them for so long. You know, they're a big part of my kind of cultural life. And so all those things fed together, and then some more personal things. You know, it's a book a little bit about male ego, male friendship, male competition, a lot of male stuff, I'm afraid. But I started from the point of wanting to write about LA.
You're a writer and a film lover, and you were living in LA. So did you ever want to write your own screenplay?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that's always something that's been in my mind. But like my character, I'm a failed screenwriter, but more in that I've never actually got around to trying it. But what's interesting, being in Los Angeles, a lot of my friends were involved in some way in the, they just call it the industry there, the film industry.
The biz.
Yeah. So, I had friends who are screenwriters and friends who are on the sort of marketing or sales side of movies. And it's tough. It's a tough business. And being there as a journalist, a kind of professional observer, was quite nice because I didn't have to have any kind of personal investment in success and failure within this kind of tough industry. So it was quite nice. You know, I could go to the Oscars and not care who won.
Be a spectator, but not panic about the competition in the industry.
So I was fascinated by it, but never had a sort of personal stake in it that could be ripped away from me at any time.
From working in LA and attending red carpet events, like you said, the Oscars, do you have any moments that were really surreal? Because, I mean, that sounds like mega what amazing to me.
It's pretty amazing. What they do with the journalists is they herd you into the hotel behind the Dolby Theatre, which is where the ceremony takes place. So you don't actually sit in the theatre and see the ceremony. You sit in a kind of giant hotel conference room at ranks and ranks of tables with your laptops out. And
do you have to wear black tie? Even?
And you still have to wear black
tie.
Do you?
Oh, I love that.
And then the winners come through and you sort of yell questions at them as they come
through. Kate Winslet, where'd you dress from? Like that, Tim.
Yeah, a little bit like that. You hold up a number like at an auction.
Oh,
and
they
point you out. I can tell you that the free buffet dinner that they give you is great. It's very good.
See, this is the kind of detail we like at Admit One. I want to know that the buffet at the Oscars for the journalists is top notch.
Yeah, I don't know what journalist standards are like for sort of buffet food, but yeah, the Lowe's Hotel buffet dinner at the Oscars is good.
Throughout the Oscar seasons that you've been covering, was there a film that you really backed or an actor or actress that you loved that when you got the opportunity and you held up your number and you had that moment to speak to them, you were unbelievably excited?
Wow. No, you know, I'm probably being a sort of cynical reporter about it, but it was, I'll tell you what was really interesting. The first year I was there was witnessing the maneuvering of the competing movies and how they, you know, negative campaigning is now, so, you know, we've just watched the presidential election. Negative campaigning is a fact of life in politics, but it is in awards season now too. So the first year that I covered the Oscars, I think, was Zero Dark Thirty and Lincoln and Argo were, I think, the main contenders. Zero Dark Thirty had this sort of campaign run against it that it was sort of pro-torture or that it had misrepresented the war on terror. Lincoln, I forget, there was some marks against Lincoln, and then the Canadians got very angry about Argo, how it had sort of suggested that the Americans were the ones who rescued the hostages and haven't given enough credit to the Canadians. And all these things end up as competing news stories in all the Hollywood trade publications.
It becomes quite political almost.
Yeah, and everyone's trying to tear down their competitors so they can get the little gold statuette.
It is amazing. I mean, the politics of the film industry, just from experience when I've done sort of Oscars and BAFTAs coverage and looked to the films, but also looked at the styling, you know, the importance, you know, Harvey Weinstein signing off what Jennifer Lawrence wears to the Oscars.
Right.
All coverage is important coverage that can support a film, and Harvey, the power players of that industry fascinate me every year.
Yeah, Harvey Weinstein created the modern Oscar campaign. He spent sort of millions and millions on the awards campaign for Shakespeare in Love to win it, the Oscar, in the year that everyone thought Saving Private Ryan was going to be the one. But, you know, that's the sheer force of, he's a sort of force of nature.
Sheer force of Weinstein.
I'm told that when he was producing My Left Foot, that Daniel Day-Lewis movie, I've never seen it, which is a terrible admission. But what I do know, or it's a sort of legend in Hollywood, whether it's apocryphal or not, is that Weinstein sent to all the sort of critics and the Academy
death threats.
chocolate feet.
Oh.
He sent chocolate feet to the Academy to promote My Left Foot.
How strange. Gimmicky and strange. See, I've heard a friend, I won't mention anyone, but has worked with him and said at all times there must be an ice cold Diet Coke ready to go.
Okay.
I love that. I mean, I like an ice cold Diet Coke, but I'm definitely many years away from demanding that someone has one ready for me in a can, not a bottle, Tim, should you ever bump into him.
Okay.
Okay, so I think it's time, Tim, to hear your top three films. So what is your first choice?
Well, I'm going to go sort of chronologically through my own life and begin with Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Great film.
Is it?
In my memory, serves, you know, it's a combination of Bryan Adams.
Of course, yeah.
And Kevin Costner starring in. And it's so nostalgic for me, but it's not about me. Tim, tell me, why is that your first film?
I was born after Star Wars came out. And I think Raiders of the Lost Ark came out, you know, within a year of my being born. And then I was too young to go to see Back to the Future at the movies. So these great sort of adventure blockbusters, the real classics of that kind of film, were already canonical by the time I was sort of sentient thinking kid. And they are much better movies than Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. But I was 10 years old when that came out and I went to the movies and saw it. And I guess it felt like my own discovery. I think I saw it two or three times in the cinema and then dozens of times on video.
Would you say that's the film of the three that we talk about that you've seen the most?
Yes, absolutely. I haven't seen it in a long time, and it's the only one of the three that I didn't re-watch before I came in to see you because I was just concerned that it doesn't hold up.
Hasn't stood the test of time.
Exactly. But I remember it was the first film I watched and thought, wow, someone's actually making these things, because very crude things in, you know, like the slow motion, the fiery arrow flying in slow motion, and then there's a sort of arrow cam as an arrow flies into a tree. It's very crude, but it made me think, gosh, someone's actually sort of directing these and putting them together.
If you had to pick a favourite scene from Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, which would it be?
That's a tough one, but it's got to be something with Alan Rickman, hasn't it? It's got to be the Sheriff of Nottingham calling off Christmas, I should think. He has a long rant at the tax collector about, you know, how he should stop. I remember a lot of the lines. I can't do the whole speech, but it definitely finishes with him trying to wipe a scar off a statue of himself and saying, call off Christmas. And I think that he's the one character in it that does stand up after all these years, I think.
So evil. Brilliantly Machiavellian.
Yeah.
I mean, one scene that I can remember, and I haven't seen it in such a long time, but I just remember thinking, how does that even work? Because it's so blunt. When he says, I'll dig your heart out with a spoon.
And then Guy Gisborne
asks him. And I
thought,
good God, how do you dig out a heart with a spoon? And then I understood. Well, that's the whole point.
Yeah, his cousin is, why a spoon, cousin? Why not an axe or a knife? You know, because it's blunt, you idiot. It'll hurt more.
Yeah, I can see that vividly. You know, some scenes in films you can really draw from your memory and replay, and I can see he's on the stairs and sort of, you know, chasing and screaming and cackling like he is throughout the film.
I had a friend and I, who we were going to remake it with his dad's video camera, and we got around to casting it, and I was going to play the sheriff and he was going to be Little John and one of our friends was going to be Robin. Luckily, we didn't. There is a famous
set of guys. Oh, I wish you did, Tim.
Well, there's some guys who spent 30 years remaking Raiders of the Lost Ark, I think. I don't know that after 30 years that one would feel the same about Robin Hood as they do about Raiders. But anyway.
Well, I think, like you said, it's holding on to the love and nostalgia and maybe not watching it again.
Yeah.
Even though this conversation does make me want to go and watch it again.
Right.
So Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, we have at number one. What is your number two?
This was a tough one. You know, I had a list of 20 films that I could have stuck a pin in, but I went with Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. That came out, I think, just before I left university. It definitely came out within a year of my being sort of brutally dumped. And it's just
where you want to erase all the memories.
Yes, exactly. So I really empathised with the character and his desire to sort of wipe it all. But by the end, you realise the sort of proverb or the quote is better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. And the film kind of makes that proverb
to anyone reality. To anyone who hasn't seen Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, could you give us a rundown of the story?
Well, it's about Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet, Joel and Clementine, he's a sort of very sensitive chap, and she's kind of crazy. She's the sort of manic pixie dream girl before they existed, except she subverts that, because you find out during the course of the film they're both these very deeply flawed people, but they're in love. They have a terrible breakup. She goes to this scientist, this doctor played by Tom Wilkinson, who's figured out how to erase a person from your memory entirely. And so he and his technicians come to your house overnight, and they strap an apparatus to your head, and they remove your ex or your dead dog or your sort of estranged son or daughter from your memory entirely, so that all the pain and bad memories of that relationship are just gone when you wake up the next morning.
To anyone who's been heartbroken, like you said, we all wish we could have done that.
Yeah.
But seeing it, I mean, it's quite a trippy film to watch. The scenes are brilliantly stylized, aren't they?
Yeah, so Michel Gondry, the director, I mean, I think it was the best thing he's ever done, and maybe the best thing that Charlie Kaufman, the writer's ever done. They were kind of the perfect marriage of, yeah, he does these practical effects that really evoke the kind of quality of memories and dreams. It's really amazing to watch these memories sort of literally crumbling around Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet as they race through, trying to outrun this procedure within his own head. For a film about two sort of flawed characters that seems to be quite cynical about love, it's actually very romantic, because the way it's structured is that as they go back erasing his memory of Clementine, Joel's memory of Clementine, you start at the end of their relationship where everything's awful and they're fighting all the time. But by the time you get to his final memories of her, it's back at the beginning of their relationship where they just met and everything seemed possible. And he fights to hold on to those memories at the end. It's kind of happy and sad at the same time, which is one of my favourite things that I can get from a movie, is that feeling of sort of bittersweetness.
So that brings us on to your third film, which is?
Which is Chinatown. Chinatown's really the sort of quintessential Los Angeles movie, I think. And there's a lot of competition for that title, given how many movies have been made there.
How would you describe a film being quintessentially LA, though?
Well, as I was talking about with the novel, you know, it's a hard-boiled detective story, and that is the LA genre. And it's also the kind of water conspiracy that's behind the mystery in the film is one of the sort of foundational myths of Los Angeles itself. There's this idea that the kind of rich people around the founding of Los Angeles managed to scam the valley out of its water to make a whole bunch of... It's complicated, but they made a lot of money out of the water, which is obviously a crucial resource in a city that's really ought to be a desert. And that's one of the mysteries behind the film. So it's about LA history, albeit a sort of fictionalized version. It's the LA genre. It's even richer to watch now that I've lived there for a long time. And then Jack Nicholson, I mean, my God, the films that guy's made. Jake Gittes is such a great character. He's a, you know, unlike a lot of other detectives, where you see a Sherlock Holmes movie, you see a Poirot episode, you know, or read the literary versions, and they fix everything at the end. You know, they solve the mystery and they fix it all. And Jake Gittes solves the mystery and doesn't fix anything. He just makes it worse.
I haven't seen Chinatown, but of all of the Admit One films, that is going on my must-see list.
You must see it. Yeah, it's really fantastic, yeah.
So, Tim Walker, before you came in today, we challenged you to choose three of your favourite films. And this is the part of the podcast where I spring a final question, which is, if you had to choose an actor to play you in the story of your life, who would it be? And why?
Okay.
And it can't be Kevin Costner.
Okay. It's got to be Benicio del Toro, I think, because of that Latin magnetism. I think that really, you know, I think he could probably carry off my Latin magnetism on screen.
Absolutely. That Latin magnetism, that is the best way to explain Benicio del Toro. Tim Walker, Benicio del Toro, thank you so, so much for your time and coming on to Admit One. Great choices. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
That's it for this episode. Next week on Admit One, journalist and documentary maker Cherry Healy.
That was my first experience of a woman kicking ass in a intellectual, powerful way whilst retaining her femininity.
Don't forget to subscribe to Admit One on iTunes for more movie memories from my stellar lineup of guests.
Admit One with Antonia O'Brien is an Audioboom production. Subscribe to the series on iTunes or via the Audioboom app.